Hey, I'm CJ, a millennial. You may know me from the podcast Science with Millennials. Well, you'd be correct, but this time we're coming at you with something other than science. We're going to be utilizing Rachel's forensic science degree and my psych knowledge to bring you a podcast that will be both thrilling and chilling.
If you haven't guessed from the title, we're going to be talking about true crime. I absolutely love learning about different true crime cases and have a plethora of knowledge pent up in my brain about cases I've read about, listened to, and watched on TV. So we're going to be utilizing my forensic chemistry degree as well as CJ's psych knowledge. As a reminder, CJ doesn't know what the case is before recording the episodes, so it's a mystery for you and her. Let's open today's case file and see what's in store. Welcome to True Crime with Millennials. Are you ready to hear a story?
Oh, absolutely.
So today we are going to talk about Charisse Raggins. This is actually a kind of a cool case because I actually got to attend some of the trial for this case when I was in college. And we'll talk about a couple more ways that it's interesting as we go on. Charisse Raggins was 24 years old. She was last seen on Route 40 and Rolling Road in Catonsville, Maryland, on February 21st, 2010.
Well, no wonder why you got to see part of it then, because it's in Maryland.
Yeah.
That's cool.
The trial took place in Baltimore County, so I got to go, it was like right down the street from my college, so I got to go and watch some of the case. It was actually a requirement for one of my classes that year for me to go watch a certain amount of trial days. And I was like, well, I could go listen to a judge go through traffic tickets, or I could go to a murder trial. So,
well, it was in,
obviously,
it was in 2010.
Well, the trial wasn't. The trial was in 2017.
Oh, okay. So you were already in college.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll get into a couple of reasons why it took so long to prosecute and all that kind of stuff. Charisse lived in the 3600 block of North Rogers Avenue in Baltimore and was on the way to meet Travis Eugene Ellaby.
How far was this case from where you lived in Maryland?
So, in answer to your question, it depends, because where I grew up in Maryland is about 30 minutes south of Baltimore. But where I went to college is, like, only just maybe 10-15 minutes north of Baltimore. Well, it depends. Probably, like, 10-15 minutes north of this part of Baltimore. Baltimore is not a really huge city, so not very far from where I went to college, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, not super far. Like I said, the courthouse that this took place in was literally right down the street from my college, so... And I don't believe there was a change of venue or anything. I'm pretty sure it was the Baltimore County Police Department that did the investigation. So basically, if you think of, like, a circle, that's what Baltimore is. Baltimore is kind... It's not really a circle, but it's like a circle. And then around that goes the Baltimore Beltway, which is just a highway that goes all the way around it. And then just inside the circle, which is the Beltway, is where I went to college.
I've just never been,
like, at the very top.
Like, trying to figure out, like, geographically how far you would have been away, you know?
Yeah, like I said, she was on the way to meet Travis Eugene Ellaby in Catonsville. When growing up, Charisse Raggins went to Woodlawn High School. She enjoyed reading and watching movies. She was, you know, just a normal 24-year-old. Ellaby and Charisse met while she was a sales clerk at Party City. They had been dating about a year when she went missing. At the time of her disappearance, Charisse was unemployed and lived with her mother, Clarice Raggins. Charisse did not have a car, a bank account, credit cards, or a mobile phone. Which sounds absolutely crazy, but 2010 was 11 years ago now, so... I guess things were a lot different then.
Yeah, we were just kind of starting out with cell phones. Well, not starting out, but, like, mobile, you know, like, the phones we think of today weren't out then. I remember in 2009, I had my track phone. Like, it wasn't anything.
Right. I think I had, like, a... I think...
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I had, like, an LG chocolate or something like that. Yeah. It kind of sounds crazy now, but it's like, I mean, back then, maybe this was kind of normal.
Back then, you act like it's, like, the 1800s. I was...
Back in the old days. I was
almost graduating high school.
I was... In 2010, I was a freshman.
Gotcha.
Well, I was, like, at the beginning of 2010, I was in 8th grade and then started high school in 2010.
Man.
I was busy being emo. It's fine.
Anyway.
So, Clarice, which is Charisse's mom, this is gonna get a little confusing, sorry. They have very similar names. Clarice says Ellaby was very possessive and constantly called Charisse on a daily basis multiple times and came to the house at least 3 times a week. They usually spent weekends together at his house. When Charisse would leave his house to go home, he would call her house 3 to 4 times to see if she made it home okay. I feel like that sounds super crazy, but... Like, I don't know, from your more informed perspective, is that... That sounds like very crazy behavior to me.
See, I try not to use the word crazy just because it has, like, negative connotations to it. Like, if I'm referring to a situation, I'll use the word crazy, but, like, a person... A lot of people have undiagnosed mental disorders, so it's easy to just, like, slap the label on, like, their behaviors being quote-unquote crazy. But... It kind of just, you know, hearing from what I'm hearing is that he had a lot of issues with abandonment or, like, you were saying, possessiveness. So it, like, thinking of the time frame as well, calling 3 or 4 times to see if someone's home, do we know if it's within, like, you know, a half hour span? Is it every 5 minutes or, like, is there any information on that?
Yeah, so it, I mean, I'll go more into the phone call details later because it's pretty crazy, but, it was very frequent. Ellaby and Charisse had a large argument in February 2010 because, which, remember, is right before she went missing, because Edward Maurice Holmes, who was also known as Marcus, stopped by her house to visit her. And Ellaby arrived just as Marcus was leaving. Police were called to handle the ensuing argument. So, I mean, obviously, when there's police involved, that's probably not an ideal situation. Her mother said that she wasn't there to witness the fight, but obviously, like, the police got called, so it was definitely an escalated issue.
Yeah. It's not usually a good thing when the police are called, but I'm glad they were there to help, I guess.
Well, I don't know. In Baltimore, are they really there to help?
I don't know. You know, I don't know if they're ever there to help, but...
The Baltimore police are known... Well, I guess this was Baltimore... No, because she lived in Baltimore City, so it would have been the city police. They are known far and wide for their misconduct.
Oh.
Wow. I mean, I guess... Baltimore County isn't much better anyway, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. Her mom last saw Charisse around 4:30 p.m. on Friday, February 19th, 2010. She left the house with Ellaby. All she took with her was, like, the clothes she was wearing, and she wore her winter coat and took a small purse that couldn't have had any, like, clothes or anything in it. All her other belongings were left at home. So it clearly seemed like she wasn't planning on taking off anywhere or even really staying anywhere. Charisse was supposed to be home later that night, but when Clarice didn't hear from her on the 20th or 21st, she was concerned. Ellaby also did not call the house at all to check on her. She tried to call Ellaby on his mobile phone and home phone multiple times on the 20th and 21st. On either February 22nd or 23rd, Clarisse finally was able to reach Ellaby's mother, Gail, who he lived with. Gail said Charisse and Ellerby had left. I keep wanting to say his last name Ellerby, but it's not. There's no R in there. It's just Ellerby. Gail said Charisse and Ellerby left the home on February 21st at 5 p.m. So Clarice was very concerned and called the police to file a missing persons report on February 24th. On the 25th, Ellerby called Clarice and said that him and Charisse went to a bus stop on Route 40 and Rolling Road, where she made a call and then got in a car and left with Marcus. Like, called Marcus to pick him up and then left. Once the police report was kind of set into motion, Detective Philip G. Marl was assigned the case on March 2nd, 2010, which to me seems very slow for a missing persons case. That's like a week later.
Yeah.
That a detective is assigned to a missing persons case, that seems insane to me. So I don't know if there was like a another detective or something that was assigned to the case prior to this detective, but he was the first person I could find that was assigned to the case a week after she was reported missing.
There are just like a lot of missing people in Baltimore?
Not really, but Baltimore does have a very high like crime rate. I believe the missing persons case, it might have been a jurisdictional issue because, like we said, like there's Baltimore City and then there's Baltimore County Police. She technically went missing in Baltimore County, if we're to believe Ellerby when he saw her last. But when the mother saw her last, it was Baltimore City. So I'm not sure if maybe that was the problem, but I mean, I'm sure that was very frustrating for the family, and I honestly wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't a jurisdictional issue and it was just lack of care, because...
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
On March 2nd, the detective went to Ellerby's house unannounced, and Ellerby said that they spent the weekend, February 19th to 21st, at his house. They left the house on the 21st to go to the bus stop at 5 p.m. They argued because he didn't have a car, says Charisse was mad about it, and went to the payphone to call Marcus. Ellerby says that he tried to stop her from going with Marcus, and around 5:30 p.m., Marcus shows up in a red Chevy Tahoe and picks up Charisse.
Can you remind me the age difference between the boyfriend and her?
She was 24 when she went missing.
Okay.
He was 31 at the time of her disappearance.
And she was 24?
Yeah.
Okay.
According to Ellerby, Marcus shows up in a red Chevy Tahoe at around 5:30 p.m. and picks up Charisse. He said that he walked home then. Oh, he also says that Marcus was around 30 and that he had only seen him one time before. So after the detective talked to Ellerby, he then had Clarice call on a recorded line and talk to Ellerby. His story was the same, except that he said he didn't walk home afterwards. He called his dad from a payphone for a ride because his cell phone was broken. He said when she got in the car, he figured their relationship was over and his heart was broken. That's why he stopped calling, and he promised to call her if he heard anything. A couple days later, the detective took Ellerby to the bus stop to recreate what happened. The bus stop is actually right in front of a Giant, like a grocery store. I don't know if that's a grocery store everywhere, but it's no, a grocery store in Maryland.
Literally never heard of it.
Okay, yeah, it's called Giant. It's a grocery store, not like a literal Giant.
That's what I was like, is it like a statue? Strange. Or like what?
He took him to the bus stop to recreate what happened. This time he said that Marcus arrived around 6 p.m., but that was the only real change. Then they went to the station and had him tell the story again. There were, again, a couple differences. Ellerby said Marcus arrived between 6 and 6:15, that he had never seen Marcus before, and that he couldn't ID him if he saw him again. He mentioned Charisse would mention Marcus to make him mad and jealous. So what do you think about this relationship that Charisse and Ellaby had? Like, it seems not stable, right?
Toxic. To yeah. put it in a word. Do we have anything about her side of it?
So we do get a couple of her text messages to him. I know it said that she didn't have a phone. I'm wondering if she used someone else's phone or if maybe she used to have a phone and then didn't at the time she disappeared or something like that. But we do have a couple of messages from her to him later on.
It just sounds like he's... It's okay, so when you said that he stopped calling because he was heartbroken, that says something happened. Because there's no way that he would just stop calling if he was heartbroken. If anything, he would start calling more. Like, that's a huge red flag.
Yeah, I mean, and that's definitely one of the things they used at trial, for sure. Like, dude, you stopped calling before anybody even knew she was missing.
Exactly, like, so he knew something was up.
On March 23rd, they interviewed Ellaby again after they had collected some evidence. They asked him to watch security footage from the Giant, which, like I said, is the grocery store that was near the bus stop. So they had several cameras and lots of footage. I think they said they had the footage from that day all the way from noon to 9 p.m. from all different views. One of the views even showed the payphone. I couldn't think of the word payphone. One of the camera views even showed the payphone that he said Charisse used to call Marcus. So in this interview, like I said, they had him watch the security footage. Neither Ellaby or the detectives could identify Charisse or himself or the car that Marcus was supposedly driving in any of the footage. They also confronted him with the fact that they had a record of Ellaby calling his dad on that payphone, but no record of Charisse calling Marcus. Marcus had also told the detectives that he was at work at that time, and that Charisse also didn't have his cell phone number and would not have recognized his truck. Like, they weren't that close, apparently. So, when confronted with this info, Ellaby changes his story pretty much completely. He said they did go to that bus station, but that they took a bus to Baltimore and Cary Streets to get weed. He said he lied because he didn't want to get in trouble. Which, I mean, to me that makes sense. Like, if I was out buying weed somewhere with someone and then they went missing, I don't know if I'd want to tell the police that I was buying weed, but I guess I'd rather tell the police that I was buying weed than them think that I killed somebody.
I suppose, but with the way that, you know, the federal laws are around marijuana. Oh, yeah.
I would just like to, first of all, say that literally never talk to the cops. Always ask for a lawyer. Don't say it. Just, you never have to talk to them. Don't say anything. So this time he says that the last place he saw Charisse was at the New York Fried Chicken outside the bus stop across the street from it.
Is that a restaurant?
He said, yeah.
Okay. I was thinking it's like a festival, and I was like, I want to go to that.
No. So he said he then took the bus back to Giant, and that's when he called his dad for a ride. But, like, you guys went to go buy weed together, but you just leave her there? Like, I don't understand.
So at this point, Marcus is not a suspect, correct?
Correct. And I'll go into a little more like the investigation that they did into him in a couple minutes. But yeah, at this point, Marcus is not a suspect.
Okay.
But like, it just seems weird to me to go somewhere specifically with someone to go buy weed together and then just be like, okay, bye. I don't know. I have never bought weed illegally, so I don't know. Maybe it's different. So on March 3rd, detectives did track down Marcus. Marcus said he was at work, which was confirmed by his boss. He had been at this job for 5 years at the time of the disappearance, and he stayed for another 5 years after that. At the time, he was working for a catering company. He punched in at 2:55 p.m., and him and his boss worked together until 11:51 p.m. He was never out of the boss's sight for any extended period of time, and phone records confirmed he was not in the Catonsville area.
Okay.
So now we're going to talk about the cell phone data a little bit, which is a little strange because Ellaby's phone, his cell phone was broken, but they were able to extract some data files from it. These files were then given to Christopher Coleman, who is actually my cool CSI professor's brother. They both do forensics, but he does like computer forensics.
Oh, cool.
At the time, he was the digital forensics supervisor with Baltimore County, and he examined the data. Basically, he used a program that allowed him to search for keywords in the phone's data. When he searched the word kill, he found a text from Ellaby to an unknown recipient. I guess due to the phone being broken, like, data was corrupted a little bit, and they couldn't determine who this text message was sent to. The text read, "No, I'm ready to permanently get away from her. Nothing. I'm just want to kill this bitch."
That was him saying that to someone else?
Yeah. But like I said, they couldn't determine who that message was sent to. Also, they requested everyone's phone records and found that between January 1st and March 1st, there were 946 calls between Ellaby and Charisse. That's about 16 a day.
With him, just outgoing calls from him, or them calling each other back and forth?
It's both. So the 946 is both. Out of those, 604 were Ellaby calling Charisse, and 342 of them were Charisse calling Ellaby.
Probably calling him back.
Right. So, like, what's your opinion on that, like, right off the bat?
The phone call records are just in general?
The phone call records. I mean, or if you have any general comments, too.
I don't know. The phone call thing kind of just makes me think it's, like, I mean, obviously it's a manipulative relationship. Could be on both their parts, but what we're hearing mostly is from him. And when people are trying to, like, control each other, especially when it's the main person that's abusing, they like to keep tabs on the person that they're with and may consistently accuse them of cheating or doing all these other bad things that the person that the accuser might actually be doing themselves. So I'm honestly surprised he didn't force her to try and move in with him with all of this basically tracking that he could do.
16 calls a day? I've never called anybody in my life 16 times a day. Remember, she went missing on the 21st, so for like a week of this time frame, she was missing.
Right.
So it was probably even more than that a day.
What, you said he stopped calling though, right? After he claimed they broke up?
Yeah, because he stopped calling after she went missing. To me, like, I don't know. I just feel like 16 calls a day is more than I want to talk to anybody in my entire life ever.
Right, and if he's calling her 3-4 times after she's going home, that, you know, he knows where she is basically at all times. And then they break up, quote-unquote break up, and then he doesn't care enough to call her or anything.
Right.
No.
Also from this phone data, the text about I'm just want to kill this bitch was sent between February 10th at 1:06 a.m. and February 11th at 10:27 a.m. They couldn't exactly pinpoint the time, but they could. There was like other messages that were around it, and they had timestamps on those. I'm definitely not a computer person, and I don't know what specifically was like wrong with this. Like, why they wouldn't be able to get this data. Like, maybe if that one text was deleted or something. I don't know, though. That's totally just me speculating. in the phone data, there were 68 messages from January 22nd to February 17th. There were 4 to Charisse and 6 from Charisse. On January 22nd, 2010, Charisse texted Ellaby at 4:26 p.m. "I see your phone died, but you chose to ignore me. Up till it did. Guess saving your battery for your ride. But you really have showed me that you can't make me happy. You don't." Less than a second later, she sent, "You don't care to. Tried making it work. Plan B, moving on. I really do love you, but I'm tired of all the hurt and senseless frustration."
So she sends this right before his phone is gonna die.
Yeah, it seems like maybe she was trying to, like, call him or something, and then his phone died or something. I don't know. We don't really know the exact circumstances, but...
to me, it sounds like an escape route, because if his phone is about to die, that means he can't call back or obsessively text her or obsessively call her or call everyone. You know, that's saying, like, I'm done, but this is a way for me to get away from this situation. And that's, like, a month before, you know. So,
yeah,
they must have gotten back together then, right?
Well, so we have a couple more texts. So at 5:57 p.m. that same day, she says, "I'm sure you're completely unconscious. Still you've right. Well, I'm out of here. Bye." On February 11th, 2010 is the last message we have from Charisse to him. And it says, "Know this. I did love you, but all we have is hate. You're no longer welcome in my life. Just walk away. Goodbye."
How did they end up... I wish I had more information as to how they ended up continuing on this relationship past that point. Or do we?
Yeah, I don't know. It was... So this trial ends up being pretty strange because Ellaby decides to choose a bench trial, which means he waives his right to a jury and the judge makes the decision, which I don't know, because I can see it from both ways, because people can be crazy, and if 12 of them are deciding your fate and they're just like random people off the street that don't know anything about forensics or anything like that, they can make very strange decisions. But also, like, if it's 12 people, you only have to convince one that you're innocent. Whereas if it's the judge, you have to convince her. And, like, I don't know. I can see both sides from, like, a which one would be better if you were the defendant, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, in case you didn't know that, that is one of your rights. You can be like, I do not want a jury trial, and the judge will decide.
I had no idea about that, honestly.
Yep. It's called a bench trial, and it's a pretty rare thing. People don't usually do that, because, like I said, with a jury trial, you just have to convince one out of 12 people that you didn't do it, and then it's a hung jury, and they have to either retry you. But then also, I feel like in a jury trial, like... I don't know what the right word for it is, but, like, mob mentality kind of kicks in, and, like, you can almost be bullied into, like, changing your mind.
Like peer pressure?
Yeah, that's probably the word I was looking for.
I mean, mob mentality can be, yeah, I guess utilized in that way, like, phrased for that, but it's more like, it's technically peer pressure, peer influence, influencing your decision, but there's another word for it that I cannot think of. If it comes to be later, then I will be more than happy to tell you, but right now we're going to go with peer pressure.
So then I think the federal marshals actually searched nationwide for any evidence of Charisse, any airline records, any passport records, anything, like any loans, anything in Charisse's name, and there was nothing in, like, the 5 years that followed this case. The reason that the trial took so long to happen is because they have never found her body. So proving a murder case when you don't have a body is very difficult, because you have to prove that the person is even dead before you can try to prove who killed her.
I know it's a load of crap, but did they put him under a lie detector test?
Not that I know of, but most of my information for this case was from the trial transcripts and an opinion from an appellate judge. So he did appeal. He is convicted, and he did appeal his conviction. We'll talk more about his conviction in a second. And you can't bring up polygraphs in a trial, so I'm not sure they could have, but lie detector tests are 100% bullshit. Never take one.
I just, you know, what you can learn from them is not necessarily what's coming up on the chart or whatever. It's just how, like I've said before, it's how they're reacting to what you're saying.
But yeah, never take a polygraph test because they will never use it. They say, oh, well, we're just going to use it to rule you out. They will never use it to rule you out. They will only use it to try to implicate you. So, or to make up their minds that you're the one that did it. So don't take a polygraph test. It's a dumb idea. It never helps you. The end.
Oh, look, we have some Rachel rants in this podcast, too.
On November 29th, 2017, Ellaby was found not guilty of first-degree murder, but was found guilty of second-degree murder. The judge that tried his case said that she did not find him guilty of first-degree murder because the only proof of intent, because like we said, we don't even know like how she died or anything like that.
Or if she died.
Well, I mean, if somebody's being found guilty of her murder, they're kind of saying that she's dead. And Ellaby has never contested that she isn't dead. Usually in this kind of case where there's no body, that is the first defense they go for. Is, oh, well, she's not dead. You know, she's in Mexico living her best life. She changed her name.
Why go through all these theatrics if he's basically admitting that he did it?
I mean, he's not admitting he did it. He's never said that she's not dead.
Gotcha.
Like, he didn't use that as his defense in trial.
Did he?
He used the fact that there was no proof that he's the one that killed her.
Did he represent himself, or did he have a lawyer?
No, he had lawyers.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was court-appointed, but he had lawyers. He was sentenced to 30 years in prison, with 5 years of that suspended. So a suspended sentence, for those of you that don't know, is just when basically a judge can sentence you, say they sentence you to 30 years with 5 suspended. You'll serve 25 years, and then if you reoffend, like do anything basically, they can put you back in jail for those 5 suspended years. And then he also has 5 years of parole after he's released. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. That's all the evidence that they had at his case. Which, I don't know, what's your opinion before I say what mine is?
I don't know. It's just weird to me that... So, going back to them buying marijuana, it wasn't from a dispensary or anything.
Correct.
And she didn't have...
It was definitely illegal in Maryland in 2010.
She didn't have a vehicle, and she didn't have a phone at that time.
No.
I wonder, just from curiosity, if it had something to do with the drug deal that he just left her there.
So, I mean, it depends, because that's all going off of his word. They don't have any proof that she was ever there buying weed.
Right.
That was never substantiated or anything. I remember my thoughts during this case actually having been sitting in the courtroom. I was very shocked when I heard that he had been convicted. I did not think that any of the case was compelling in a way that made me have beyond a reasonable doubt convinced that he was guilty, because I think she's alive? Probably not. But, like, am I beyond a reasonable doubt convinced she's not alive? Not really.
It really...
And I'm also... They have absolutely no physical evidence, which that's... actually very common for cases to be entirely circumstantial, but I feel like in this case, the circumstantial evidence shows that there was a nasty relationship, a toxic relationship, but that doesn't show murder, in my opinion.
I just feel like it could go either way. Like, she just, it could have been like she wanted to disappear and he took the fall for it and is now in prison. Or it could be that he really did do something and is just completely lying about it and knows where she's buried or, you know, knows what happened to her.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, from my perspective, I always hate when people are like, oh, well, he didn't grieve properly. And I'm like, nobody grieves the same way. You never know how somebody's going to react to somebody, something happened.
Right.
Yeah, it's weird that he stopped calling. But, I mean, is it impossible that he really just thought they were broken up and was like, done?
I don't necessarily think it's impossible, but it's not likely.
Because, remember, the level you have to reach to find somebody guilty is beyond a reasonable doubt. And I feel like I have several reasonable doubts in this case. Because, like, just because you're a crappy partner doesn't mean you killed them.
Right.
Yeah, maybe you're more likely to have killed them than if you're, like, a fantastic partner. But, like, we can't just, anytime somebody dies, just be like, okay, well, they had a crappy relationship, so we're gonna put them in jail.
I don't even think it's that. It's just, like, the evidence of the text messages that really speak against it, you know?
You, against what, sorry?
Him being innocent.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, we really only have, like, that one message from him to that random person, which, like, people say they want to kill people all the time.
But you don't put it in writing.
Well, yeah, but just because you're stupid doesn't mean you murdered someone. That's my new slogan.
Just because you're stupid doesn't mean you murdered someone.
That should be our first merch shirt for the show. But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do it. I think he probably did it. But I'm saying I don't necessarily think he should have been convicted of it with the evidence that there is.
Yeah.
There are a couple of places in Baltimore that are, like, the places to get rid of bodies. It's, like, the first thing that comes up if you search, like, the first three letters of the park. And this is, like, in Baltimore. So there are places that you can go in Baltimore to, like, hide a body, but also, like, this park, the reason it's known as, like, the place you dump bodies is because they're found all the time. Because this is, like, a fairly heavily trafficked area. Like, it's a city. I just, like, we're, what, now 10 years on? No, 11 years on? And, like, her body still has not been found in this heavily, like, trafficked area. And, I mean, this guy, to me, at least, doesn't seem like this mastermind criminal who's gonna have, like, who's gonna plan the perfect crime, you know?
You never know, though.
I feel like so many things just had to go perfectly for him to have committed this crime, and I don't know if I believe in that much to, like, say he did it beyond. Okay, I would be, if I ever get called for jury duty, the defense is going to be like, yes, we want her on the jury, and the prosecution is going to be like, get the heck out. Because you best thoroughly convince me that somebody did it for me to say that they're guilty, because I am so suspicious of all, like, police work, and just, I don't know, I'm just a very suspicious person.
So, to me, it sounds like they convicted him because they didn't have anyone else, and they wanted someone to blame.
Yeah, which, honestly, I'm surprised they even bothered trying this case, especially since it's, like, I mean, I'm glad they tried this case, I guess. Like, I'm glad that this mother had this chance to get closure and stuff, but just Black people get forgotten in Baltimore so frequently.
And it happens everywhere, not just in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah. I have another case from Baltimore that we'll definitely be talking about because I took a full class in college about that case. And we literally went to, like, all the different, like, locations in the case. Her body is actually one of the bodies in that park. That's another case like this where it's like, but it'll be another one of those where you're like, who did it? I don't, I'm conflicted. But yeah, I mean, I'm just always so skeptical of everything.
I just thought of something. What if his mom is involved in it?
See, because no one except for him and his mom saw her since, or heard from her since the 19th.
Right.
And her mom said it wasn't normal for her to go a day without calling her. So, I mean, that's definitely a possibility, too. Because she was supposed to come home on the 19th.
Right.
And her mom said, I actually got to watch her mom testify. And it was very emotional. She said that it was not usual for her daughter to go even a day without speaking to her. And, like, if she had changed her mind and wanted to stay there for the weekend, she would have told her.
Right. And it's weird to me that the like Ellaby's mom didn't pick up the phone until what, the 21st?
21st is when she went missing. So I think it was the 23rd or 24th when she finally got a hold of Ellaby's mom.
Why did she have to call so much to get a hold of her is what I want to know.
Right. And or like to get a hold of either of them, and then he didn't call her till like a day or two later, and it's just like, I mean, I definitely think there are so many things that are sketchy, but I don't know. I'm not sold. I'm very rarely sold. So,
I mean, honestly,
that's going to be a common theme in this show, is me being skeptical of convictions.
I'm more sold on the mom having something to do with it than him.
I mean, I feel like if the mom had something to do with it, he did too. I don't think it's like a...
Oh, yeah, but like
I don't think she really had any reason to do anything on her own about it.
Yeah.
That doesn't really make sense to me, but yeah, it is weird. I'm not sure.
I'm not saying she directly did it, but she could have been like an accomplice, like helping him, or like, I don't know, maybe if she didn't like,
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I think cases like this where there's no body are just so difficult because like, there's just so many questions. There's just even more questions than usual. And yeah, to this day, they've never found her body. So, I mean, if you had never heard of this case, but now you realize that you saw something then that, you know, nobody has, that we didn't mention in this podcast, then you can contact the Baltimore County Police Department. I don't know if they'll do anything since it's a closed case, but I should hope they would, because I hope they want to, like, find her and return her to her family, but I have kind of low hopes about that, so if they don't do anything, I don't know, I guess email us and, I don't know, we'll go on a tirade about it or something.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out, I guess.
Rachel will just spam the Baltimore police.
I'll just fly home and investigate it my damn self. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, if you do know anything, it'd be really awesome if, I'm sure, for her family to have her return to them. And I mean, that could also potentially, you know, if he is wrongfully convicted, it could potentially bring that to light. So, yeah. I don't know. I don't usually tell people to call the police. That's weird.
Yeah.
There are very rare times when I would ever call the police for anything.
So, I suppose my closing thoughts on this are, we don't know enough to come to a conclusion, but their relationship was very toxic, and there's potential and motive for him to kill her, especially with saying that he's going to, but we don't necessarily know.
To me, it even, I mean, like I said, the only thing, because Charisse is missing, the only thing we really get to hear from her side is the text messages. And from those, I can't really tell if it seems like it was a toxic both ways relationship, like a very volatile, you know, back and forth, they're both causing it, or if it was really just a one-way manipulative kind of relationship. Do you have any thoughts on that?
What did the mom say about their relationship besides that she didn't really like him?
I think she mostly just said that, I can't remember, I'm pretty sure she mostly said that she didn't really know that much about their relationship. I believe, if I remember correctly, that she worked a lot.
Oh, okay.
But I could be wrong.
I just kind of wonder, because if they were that close, she would have told her something.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it does say that she said, the mom says that their relationship was riddled with issues and often argumentative. But that's all I can really find. As far as I could find, the family of Charisse was pretty quiet about this, at least to the media, which, you know, is understandable. Some people like to, you know, grieve more quietly than others. But yeah, as far as I can tell, her family was pretty private about this case.
It's very interesting, and there's a lot of moving parts that we don't have a lot of information on, so.
Yeah, I wish I could have found more information about this case, but it surprisingly wasn't, like, super well covered.
Which is dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it had to do with the fact that she's, you know, not white.
This is the first time I've ever even heard of this, and I used to watch the news like crazy when I was in high school. I'd watch it every morning.
I don't think it was really reported anywhere outside of, like, Maryland. And I had never heard of it before I literally sat down in the courtroom. But yeah, I don't know. It's just very strange. The trial was only 3 days.
That's not that long, right?
No, that's not very long. And I mean, I guess it makes sense to me because there was really only a couple of witnesses. It was my professor's brother, the computer forensics person, and Clarice. She testified saying that how out of character it was for her daughter to just go missing. So, yeah, I don't know. I just have a lot of questions.
Me too. And I'm, you know, out to her family, I'm really sorry for your loss, and it's something that I wouldn't wish upon anybody, you know, it's just, and to not even have that closure, I can't even imagine how that feels.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I definitely think that her family believes that Ellaby killed her. I think they believe that she is no longer alive, but I'm sure they have just as many questions as we do, and to not even know, like, what happened to her, like, how she died, where she is, that must be so hard, I can't even imagine.
Has he said anything since he's been in prison, like, about the case? Because, you know, sometimes they interview people after they go to prison about what they did and all that.
I don't think he's said anything publicly. All that he has... I know that he appealed his sentence, but I don't think that he's said anything publicly. He is definitely still in jail, because I found his address. You can mail him shit, but
it's only been, like, 4 years, though, right? So...
Yeah, it was 2017 when he was when he was sentenced, so. But yeah. He's at the Maryland Correctional Institution in Jessup, Maryland.
Where is Rowling Road located? Is it, like, in the middle of nowhere? Is it in the city?
It's Rowling Road, but...
Okay, Rowling.
It is not in the middle of nowhere at all. Like, it's not a middle of nowhere. Like, it's basically an intersection with, like, a shopping center on each corner, basically.
So they would have been seen there.
Nobody has ever said anything about seeing them there.
Interesting.
Yeah, as far as I know, I don't even know if the police looked for eyewitnesses. I would hope they did, but I don't know. Yeah. This is just one of those cases that just leaves me with even more questions than I started with.
Me too.
And, like, I feel like I have even more questions about it now than I did sitting in the courtroom when I actually was there, and... But I remember so vividly, like, sitting in the courtroom, like, listening to this case and just thinking, like, there's no way that he's going to be convicted on this. Like, this is not enough evidence to convict somebody on. And I was way less cynical when I was in college than I am now.
It just doesn't add up. It, like I said, it just seems like they were looking for someone to blame. He was the most, liable subject or suspect, and then they were like, all right, you're guilty. They didn't even really try.
I mean, yeah, like, I mean, I think there's a very real possibility that, yeah, maybe he did do something for to her, but I do not feel like the legal standard that we have in this country was met at all.
No.
Like, you can't just be like, well, this person was toxic and, you know, they stopped calling them and the person's now missing, so they killed them. But yeah, so, like, I don't, like, there's a Walmart right there. Like, I mean, it's a freaking 3-lane each way road and a 4-lane each way road. Okay, no, 4 lanes on this side, 2 lanes on that side. But, like, it's a big road. Like, it's a big intersection.
We should, we can include this link in the show notes, too.
Okay, yeah.
For the intersection, so they can see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, you want to close out the podcast?
So, yeah, thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of True Crime with Millennials. I forgot the name of our podcast for a second.
It's only our second episode. It's fine.
But, yeah, I mean, this case just leaves me with so many questions. But also, those are my favorite kind of cases and the ones that, like, really stick in my mind. And I think the ones that need more attention, too. Because maybe somebody out there has heard something or seen something and they just didn't know that it was relevant. So
yeah, and I really appreciate that you're picking cases that aren't just, like, mainstream media. You're picking ones that are, like, under the radar, almost.
I mean, I could do a lot of the mainstream media cases, like, blindfolded in my sleep. Just because I consume so many true crime podcasts and true crime shows and documentaries and all that. But yeah, I'm definitely trying to pick some cases that I mean, this one I have a semi-personal connection to, I guess. So I thought that would be really cool to talk about.
But yeah, I think it's great that you're doing that, though.
But anyway, yeah. So if you like this podcast, share it with a friend who's also interested in true crime and give it as many stars as possible on whatever platform you're listening on.
Or even if your friend isn't interested in true crime, you should still share this case so we can hopefully help solve it or find any sort of information about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those weird cases where it's solved, but it doesn't feel solved. Like, I'm sure the family doesn't feel like they have closure.
Right.
Although, I mean, I don't know how real closure is, but I'm sure they would at least like to, you know, get her remains back and stuff. So yeah, thank you guys all for listening, and we'll be back at you next time with another case.
Catch you on the flip side, dog.